who felt like there were a lot of oddities surrounding Musk's academic record, particularly the Stanford days. But as I dug in, there were solid explanations for all of the inconsistencies and plenty of evidence to undermine the cases of Musk's detractors. During the course of my reporting, for example, I found evidence that contradicted O'Reilly's timeline of events. Peter Nicholson, the banker whom Musk had worked for in Canada, took a stroll with Musk along the boardwalk in Toronto before Musk left for Stanford and chatted about the incarnations of something like Zip2. Musk had already started writing some of the early software to support the idea he'd outlined to Kimball. He was agonizing whether to do a PhD at Stanford or take this piece of software he'd made in his spare time and make a business out of it, Nicholson said. He called the thing the Virtual City Navigator. I told him there was this crazy internet thing going on and that people will pay big money for damn near anything. This software was a golden opportunity. He could do a PhD anytime. Kimball and other members of Musk's family have similar memories. Musk, speaking at length for the first time on the subject, denied everything alleged by O'Reilly and does not even recall meeting the man. "He's a total scumbag," Musk said. "O'Reilly is like a failed physicist who became a serial litigate. And I told the guy, 'Look, I'm not going to settle an unjust case, so it's just like don't even try.' But he still kept at it. His case was tossed out twice on demur, which means that basically, even if all the facts in his case were true, he would still lose. He'd tried his best to, like, torture me through my friends and personally by filing the lawsuit. And then we've got summary judgment. He lost the summary judgment. He appealed summary judgment, then several months later, lost the appeal, and I was like, 'Okay, fuck it, let's file for fees.' And we were awarded fees from when he appealed. And that's when we sent the sheriff after him, and he claimed that he had no money, basically. Whether he did or didn't, I don't know. He certainly claimed he had no money. So we were like, either we've got to, like, impound his car or tap his wife's income. Those didn't seem like great choices. So we decided that he doesn't have to pay back the money he owes me, so long as he doesn't sue anyone else on frivolous grounds. And in fact, late last year or early this year, 2014, he tried to do just that thing. But whoever he sued was aware of the nature of my judgment and contacted the lawyer I used, who then told O'Reilly, 'Look, you need to drop the case against these guys, or everyone's going to ask for the money. It's kind of pointless to sue them on frivolous grounds because you're going to have to fork over the winnings to Elon. It's like, go do something productive with your life.' As for his academic records, Musk produced a document for me dated June 22, 2009, that came from Judith Haku, the director of graduate admissions in the office of the registrar at Stanford University. It read, "As per special request from my colleagues in the School of Engineering, I have searched Stanford's admission database and acknowledge that you applied and were admitted to the graduate program in Material Science Engineering in 1995. Since you did not enroll, Stanford is not able to issue you an official certification document." Musk also had an explanation for the weird timing on his degrees from Penn. "I had a history and an English credit that I agreed with Penn that I would do at Stanford," he said. "Then I put Stanford on deferment. Later, Penn's requirements changed so that you don't need the English and history credit. So then they awarded me the degree in 97 when it was clear I was not going to go to grad school, and their requirement was no longer there. I finished everything that was needed for a Wharton degree in 94. They'd actually mailed me a Wharton degree. I decided to spend another year and finished the physics degree, but then there was that history and English credit thing. I was only reminded about the history and English thing when I tried to get an H-1B visa and called the school to get a copy of my graduation certificate, and they said I hadn't graduated. Then they looked into the new requirements and said it was fine." Appendix 2. While Musk has reflected publicly about his time at PayPal and the coup, he went into far greater detail than ever before during one of our longer interviews. Years had passed since the tumultuous days surrounding his ouster, and Musk had been able to meditate more on what went right, what went wrong, and what might have been. He started by discussing his decision to go out of the country, mixing business with a delayed honeymoon, and ended with an explanation of how the finance industry still hasn't solved the problems X.com wanted to tackle. The problem with me going away was that I was not there to reassure the board on a few things, like the brand change. I think it would have been the right move, but it didn't need to happen right then. At the time, it was this weird, almost hybrid brand with X.com and PayPal. I think the X was the right long-term brand for something that wants to be the central place where all transactions happen. That's the X. It's like the X is the transaction. PayPal doesn't make sense in that context, when we're talking about something more than a personal payment system. I think X was the more sensible approach, but timing-wise, it didn't need to happen then. That should have probably waited longer. As for the technology change, that's not really well understood. On the face of it, it doesn't sound like it makes much sense for us to be writing our front-end code in Microsoft C++ instead of Linux. But the reason is that the programming tools for Microsoft and a PC are actually extremely powerful. They're developed for the gaming industry. I mean, this is going to sound like heresy in a sort of Silicon Valley context, but you can program faster. You can get functionality faster in the PC C++ world. All of the games for the Xbox are written in Microsoft C++. The same goes for games on the PC. They're incredibly sophisticated, hard things to do. And these great tools have been developed thanks to the gaming industry. There were more smart programmers in the gaming industry than anywhere else. I'm not sure the general public understands this. It was also 2000, and there were not the huge software libraries for Linux that you would find today. Microsoft had huge support libraries, so you could get a DLL that could do anything, but you couldn't get Linux libraries that could do anything. Two of the guys that left PayPal went off to Blizzard and helped create World of Warcraft. When you look at the complexity of something like that, living on PCs and Microsoft C++, it's pretty incredible. It blows away any website. In retrospect, I should have delayed the brand transition, and I should have spent a lot more time with Max getting him comfortable on the technology. I mean, it was a little difficult because, like, the Linux system Max had created was called Max Code. So Max has had quite a strong affinity for Max Code. This was a bunch of libraries that Max and his friends had done. But it just made it quite hard to develop new features. And if you look at PayPal today, I mean, part of the reason they haven't developed any new features is because it's quite difficult to maintain the old system. Ultimately, I didn't disagree with the board's decision in the PayPal case, in the sense that with the information that the board had, I would have made maybe the same decision. I probably would have, whereas in the case of Zip2, I would not have. I thought they just simply made a terrible decision based on information they had. I don't think the X.com board made a terrible decision based on the information they had. But it did make me want to be careful about who invested in my companies in the future. I've thought about trying to get PayPal back. I've just been too strung out with other things. Almost no one understands how PayPal actually worked, or why it took off when other payment systems before and after it didn't. Most of the people at PayPal don't understand this. The reason it worked was because the cost of transactions in PayPal was lower than any other system. And the reason the cost of transactions was lower is because we were able to do an increasing percentage of our transactions as ACH, or automated clearinghouse, electronic transactions, and most importantly, internal transactions. Internal transactions were essentially fraud-free and cost us nothing. An ACH transaction costs, I don't know, like 20 cents or something. But it was slow, so that was the bad thing. It's dependent on the bank's batch processing time. And then the credit card transaction was fast, but expensive in terms of the credit card processing fees, and very prone to fraud. That's the problem Square is having now. Square is doing the wrong version of PayPal. The critical thing is to achieve internal transactions. This is vital because they are instant, fraud-free, and fee-free. If you're a seller and have various options, and PayPal has the lowest fees and is the most secure, it's obviously the right thing to use. When you look at any given business, like say a business is making 10% profitability, they're making 10% profit when they may net out all of their costs. You know, revenue minus expenses in a year, they're 10%. If using PayPal means you pay 2% for your transactions, and using some other systems means you pay 4%, that means using PayPal gives you a 20% increase in your profitability. You'd have to be brain dead not to do that, right? So because about half of PayPal's transactions in the summer of 2001 were internal or ACH transactions, then our fundamental costs of transactions were half, because we'd have half credit cards. We'd have that, and then the other half would be free. The question, then, is how do you give people a reason to keep money in the system? That's why we created a PayPal debit card. It's a little counterintuitive, but the easier you make it for people to get money out of PayPal, the less they'll want to do it. But if the only way for them to spend money or access it in any way is to move it to a traditional bank, that's what they'll do instantly. The other thing was the PayPal Money Market Fund. We did that because if you consider the reasons that people might move the money out, well, they'll move it to either conduct transactions in the physical world or because they're getting a higher interest rate. So I instituted the highest return money market fund in the country. Basically, the money market fund was at cost. We didn't intend to make any money on it, in order to encourage people to keep their money in the system. And then we also had, like, the ability to pay regular bills, like your electricity bill, and that kind of thing, on PayPal. There were a bunch of things that should have been done, like checks. Because even though people don't use a lot of checks, they still use some checks. So if you force people to say, okay, we're not going to let you use checks ever, they're like, okay, I guess I have to have a bank account. Just give them a few checks, for God's sake. I mean, it's so ridiculous that PayPal today is worse than PayPal circa end of 2001. That's insane. None of these startups understand the objective. The objective should be, what delivers fundamental value? I think it's important to look at things from a standpoint of what is actually the best thing for the economy. If people can conduct their transactions quickly and securely, that's better for them. If it's simpler to conduct their financial life, it's better for them. So if all your financial affairs are seamlessly integrated one place, it's very easy to do transactions, and the fees associated with transactions are low. These are all good things. Why aren't they doing this? It's mad. Appendix 3. From Elon Musk. Date, June 7th, 2013. 12:43:06 a.m. PDT. 2. All@spacex.com. Subject, going public. Per my recent comments, I am increasingly concerned about SpaceX going public before the Mars transport system is in place. Creating the technology needed to establish life on Mars is and always has been the fundamental goal of SpaceX. If being a public company diminishes that likelihood, then we should not do so until Mars is secure. This is something that I am open to reconsidering, but given my experiences with Tesla and Solar City, I am hesitant to foist being public on SpaceX, especially given the long-term nature of our mission. Some at SpaceX who have not been through a public company experience may think that being public is desirable. This is not so. Public company stocks, particularly if big step changes in technology are involved, go through extreme volatility, both for reasons of internal execution and for reasons that have nothing to do with anything except the economy. This causes people to be distracted by the manic depressive nature of the stock instead of creating great products. It is important to emphasize that Tesla and SolarCity are public because they didn't have any choice. Their private capital structure was becoming unwieldy, and they needed to raise a lot of equity capital. SolarCity also needed to raise a huge amount of debt at the lowest possible interest rate to fund solar leases. The banks who provide that debt wanted SolarCity to have the additional and painful scrutiny that comes with being public. Those rules, referred to as Sarbanes-Oxley, essentially result in a tax being levied on company execution by requiring detailed reporting right down to how your meal is expensed during travel, and you can be penalized even for minor mistakes. Yes, but I could make more money if we were public. For those who are under the impression that they are so clever that they can outsmart public market investors and would sell SpaceX stock at the right time, let me relieve you of any such notion. If you really are better than most hedge fund managers, then there is no need to worry about the value of your SpaceX stock, as you can just invest in other public company stocks and make billions of dollars in the market. If you think, "Ah, but I know what's really going on at SpaceX, and that will give me an edge," you are also wrong. Selling public company stock with insider knowledge is illegal. As a result, selling public stock is restricted to narrow time windows a few times per year. Even then, you can be prosecuted for insider trading. At Tesla, we had both an employee and an investor go through a grand jury investigation for selling stock over a year ago, despite them doing everything right in both the letter and spirit of the law. Not fun. Another thing that happens to public companies is that you become a target of the trial lawyers who create a class action lawsuit by getting someone to buy a few hundred shares and then pretending to sue the company on behalf of all investors for any drop in the stock price. Tesla is going through that right now, even though the stock price is relatively high, because the drop in question occurred last year. It is also not correct to think that because Tesla and SolarCity share prices are on the lofty side right now, that SpaceX would be too. Public companies are judged on quarterly performance. Just because some companies are doing well doesn't mean that all would. Both of those companies, Tesla in particular, had great first quarter results. SpaceX did not. In fact, financially speaking, we had an awful first quarter. If we were public, the short sellers would be hitting us over the head with a large stick. We would also get beaten up every time there was an anomaly on the rocket or spacecraft, as occurred on Flight 4 with the engine failure and Flight 5 with the Dragon pre-valves. Delaying launch of V1.1, which is now over a year behind schedule, would result in particularly severe punishment, as that is our primary revenue driver. Even something as minor as pushing the launch back a few weeks from one quarter to the next gets you a spanking. Tesla vehicle production in Q4 last year was literally only 3 weeks behind, and yet the market response was brutal. Best of both worlds. My goal at SpaceX is to give you the best aspects of a public and private company. When we do a financing round, the stock price is keyed off of approximately what we would be worth if publicly traded, excluding irrational exuberance or depression, but without the pressure and distraction of being under a hot public spotlight. Rather than have the stock be up during one liquidity window and down during another, the goal is a steady upward trend and never to let the share price go below the last round. The end result for you, or an investor in SpaceX, financially, will be the same as if we were public and you sold a steady amount of stock every year. In case you are wondering about a specific number, I can say that I'm confident that our long-term stock price will be over $100 if we execute well on Falcon 9 and Dragon. For this to be the case, we must have a steady and rapid cadence of launch that is far better than what we have achieved in the past. We have more work ahead of us than you probably realize. Let me give you a sense of where things stand financially. SpaceX expenses this year will be roughly $800 to $900 million, which blows my mind, BTW. Since we get revenue of $60 million for every F-9 flight, or double that for a FH or F-9 Dragon flight, we must have about 12 flights per year, where 4 of those flights are either Dragon or Heavy, merely in order to achieve 10% profitability. For the next few years, we have NASA commercial crew funding that helps supplement those numbers, but after that, we are on our own. That is not much time to finish F-9, FH, Dragon V-2, and achieve an average launch rate of at least 1 per month. And bear in mind, that is an average, so if we take an extra 3 weeks to launch a rocket for any reason, could even be due to the satellite, we have only 1 week to do the follow-on flight. My recommendation. Below is my advice about regarding selling SpaceX stock or options. No complicated analysis is required, as the rules of thumb are pretty simple. If you believe that SpaceX will execute better than the average public company, then our stock price will continue to appreciate at a rate greater than that of the stock market, which would be the next highest return place to invest money over the long term. Therefore, you should sell only the amount that you need to improve your standard of living in the short to medium term. I do actually recommend selling some amount of stock, even if you are certain it will appreciate, as life is short and a bit more cash can increase fun and reduce stress at home, so long as you don't ratchet up your ongoing personal expenditures proportionately. To maximize your post-tax return, you are probably best off exercising your options to convert them to stock, if you can afford to do this, and then holding the stock for a year before selling it at our roughly biannual liquidity events. This allows you to pay the capital gains tax rate instead of the income tax rate. On a final note, we are planning to do a liquidity event as soon as Falcon 9 qualification is complete, in 1 to 2 months. I don't know exactly what the share price will be yet, but based on initial conversations with investors, I would estimate probably between $30 and $35. This places the value of SpaceX at $4 to $5 billion, which is about what it would be if we were public right now, and frankly, an excellent number, considering that the new F-9, FH, and Dragon V-2 have yet to launch. Elon. This is Fred Sanders. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Elon Musk, Tesla, SpaceX, and the Quest for a Fantastic Future by Ashley Vance. This program was produced by Dion Audio Services. Executive producer, Katie Ostroka. Text copyright 2015 by Ashley Vance. Production copyright 2015 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.